The Public Safety Finance Division will come to order. Just wanted to go over the agenda real briefly. We will be hearing today a little bit out of order because of people's schedules, but we wanted to hear from the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women, as well as the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault, two fairly significant coalitions that get funding from through our committee, through OJP, and talk about sort of the current need, but also, I didn't ask them to prepare, but maybe you could just think about it in the next few seconds here before you come up, what it would mean if this committee was required to cut your coalitions 5-7%, what that would actually mean to state programming. Then we will hear from the Department of Public Safety on the governor's supplemental recommendations, the BCA's expenditure for a sex offender registry, and then one that presentation that we had to postpone a couple of weeks ago. We'll hear from Harry Kennedy, who will review the federal Adam Walsh Act, and there'll be time for public comment at the end of the hearing. We also will hear, and I suspect that we'll be getting maybe this will answer your question before you ask it. I think we'll be getting our targets very soon here, so we can start preparing to look at what this committee will have to cut, and we'll be bringing all the agencies back in here and asking some very hard questions. I think Thursday we start with the courts. And then we will be hearing bills, and that's about it. Of course.
Mr. Chair, thank you. You did read my mind a bit. If we're going to have the courts in here Thursday, are we going to have a target by then? Or what has your leadership told you about when we're going to be getting targets?
Libby says we don't know.
If your caucus runs anything like mine, I would look to staff for the best information, because that's certainly what we do in our caucus as well. Mr. Chair, I look forward to seeing the target. I'm not looking forward to the work that we have to do, but we do have a big problem. And just a reminder, members, staff, witnesses, please turn off your cell phones.
Thank you. You know, that was on my list that Libby told me to ask, and I did not. So, yes, please shut off your cell phones, even if you have them on vibrate. They interact with our sound system, and it's quite quiet here right now, but it has not been in the past. So, without any further ado, I think we'll start with MCPW. Connie Moore, are you here? Or a representative? Ms. Moore, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning, Chairman Paymar and committee members. My name is Connie Moore, and I'm the executive director at Alexandra House, and we're located in Anoka County. Our shelter is located in Blaine, and we have an office in the city of Anoka as well. I appreciate the opportunity this morning to present to you the importance of funding for domestic violence and sexual assault programs in our state. Recently, Alexandra House took on providing services to sexual violence victims as well, and that began in October of 2009. So we are now a dual program as well. As you look at the budget and contemplate funding cuts, I ask that you critically weigh the significance of funding to domestic violence and sexual assault programs. Domestic violence is costing our communities. It is costing our communities both in terms of women's and children's lives, but also in terms of money. In 2009, at least 12 women and 10 children lost their lives due to domestic violence. One of those women was Pamela Tashuk, a woman who lived in Anoka County, a woman who suffered over the course of her 23-year marriage severe abuse. A woman who sought the protection from law enforcement, the courts, and from our program. And despite all of her efforts, on October 1st, Pamela Tashuk was shot to death in her home by her estranged husband. Pamela Taschek's death is tragic. It illustrates the absolute dangers and very real costs of domestic violence. While we can tell you the number of women killed by domestic violence, we cannot give you exact numbers of women who avoided death by use of our services. We do know that our programs provide a critical safety net for many women and children. You have written testimony from two women who are certain they would be dead if they had not received services from their local domestic violence programs. I believe that's Jennifer Denmark and Penny Peters' testimonies. Promoting safety is a core function of our government. Every Minnesotan should have a right to safety, including safety in their own home. Our programs promote safety and provide critical services that help women and children rebuild their lives, lives free from violence. We are the only agency in Anoka County providing these services. In 2009, Alexandra House provided services to over 2,700 victims of domestic violence. Services included emergency shelter, crisis intervention, personal advocacy, support, legal advocacy, legal assistance, financial assistance to maintain and or secure affordable and safe housing, follow-up support services, violence prevention services in local school districts, and much more. We also provide community education and professional training services. There are domestic violence and sexual assault service programs located in almost every area in the state, providing these critical, life-saving services in their local communities. We are asking that you invest in domestic violence and sexual assault programs. This investment is critical for the safety and well-being of our communities. With the past state funding cuts to domestic and sexual assault programs, have come other funding reductions from local government sources. In these difficult economic times, we are also experiencing loss of foundation grants and individual contributions. Further funding cuts to emergency shelter and other domestic violence and sexual assault crime victim service grants will have a significant impact on the level of services agencies like Alexandra House will be able to sustain. In your question, Chairman Paymar, in terms of what 5 to 7% cut in funding for our program would mean, it would have a significant impact. We have already, I think, cut to pretty much the bare bones, particularly in our emergency shelter program. We're utilizing volunteers as much as possible. We've created an adopt-a-room program to try to cut down on maintenance and other costs. So there's a lot of creative things that we've done in partnerships that we've entered into to try to continue to provide the level of services that we know victims of domestic violence need in our community. Further cuts will only make that much more difficult. We've also experienced, as I said, cuts from local government. So as they look at their budget issues, the funding that we have received from our local cities and our county have also been cut, and we anticipate that will continue to happen in this next year as well. So these dollars from the state are critical in order for us to maintain the services that we know need to be there for victims of domestic violence in our community.
Ms. Moore, I don't want to put you on the spot here, but cell phones. Representative Eastland, is that yourself?
Turning it off. I don't think it's mine.
There was a 3% cut to Battered Women's Programs last year. Mm-hmm. What impact did that have? I guess there's three questions. Is your shelter full? And can you be a little bit more specific on what a 5 to 7% cut would mean to your program? And I'm asking you to speak for all the programs.
Well, the Office of Justice Programs was able to compensate for that 3% cut this last year, so we didn't really have it. It wasn't a huge impact on us. If we had a 5 to 7% cut, depending on what area we were cut in, we would probably significantly, obviously we have to keep our shelter open. So we must have those 24-hour emergency shelter services. We would more than likely cut our programming to victims that are utilizing our community program services, which includes our criminal justice intervention services, our civil court services, you know, working with women who are going through the criminal or civil court system, support groups, probably be looking at what we're doing in the schools. We have a, we're in four local school districts, and so the work that we do in the schools is prevention as well as intervention focused. So we'd probably be looking at, you know, how much of that we could we sustain, which we really value because we look at that as the long-term solution to this issue. So I'm guessing in order to keep the level of services we have in the shelter, we'd probably be looking at making some reductions in terms of how we're operating our community program.
Okay. Any questions of Ms. Moore, Representative Smith?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Of the testifier, what is the total bed space available to Alexandra's house?
We have 35 beds. And I forgot in your question in terms of are we full. We are not always full, but every day is different because we have families coming and going. We have been much more at capacity this past year. We had an increase. We were, I think, of over 50 women and kids in this past year utilizing our services in the emergency shelter. We've seen an increase in the number of victims looking for all different kinds of services. So in Anoka County, if we're full, because we are the only shelter, we will take in an Anoka County family and make arrangements for them to at least have shelter for that evening and try to figure out different solutions the next day. So there are times where we are over capacity. So,
Mr. Chairman, what is your average occupancy rate of the beds?
We have an average occupancy rate of 16 to 18 days.
No, ma'am. I mean,
Representative Smith,
do you have, what's the average occupancy rate of the beds on a given year? Are you 100% full or 85% full?
Ms. Moore.
Yes.
Go ahead.
I don't have the numbers for 2009, the actual percentage, but I know we're close to 90% or more.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So it on average, you're about 10% not occupied.
Ms. Moore?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mr. Chairman, one or two more questions. Do you fill out any forms for the state reporting data and information like I just asked?
Yes, we
Ms.
do.
Ms. Moore?
Ms. Chairman, ma'am, do you also... In those forms, you referenced 2,700 victims being served, some of which are, you described a little bit, civil legal services. Do you also report to the state on those 2,700 victims as to the services received, what kind, and the costs incurred?
Ms. Moore.
Yes, we do.
Ms. Chairman.
Representative Smith.
Is it your intent to have this witness back, this specific witness, later?
We certainly could.
I would request that whatever reporting you do to the state that covers at least those two areas, the description of the victim services, the cost, and also the bed occupancy rate, if you have that in writing, I would appreciate it being submitted. Also, Mr. Chair, I would also at some point like to hear from the State Bar Association to see what kind of programs are in place with the State Bar that could backfill, just as OJP apparently backfilled the 3% cuts. I'd like to see what the bar is doing to back you up in the event you would have to cut some of those legal services. So testimony from the bar would be helpful.
We do work with Central Minnesota Legal Services as well as Judicare, and they do provide pro bono services to women that we are working with who have filed orders for protection or needing legal representation. We have volunteer attorneys who come in and work with our clients in addressing any kind of family court or domestic violence issues that they have. So we do have some partnerships out there with different legal aid programs.
Thank you, Representative Smith. So, Ms. Moore, do you understand the request? Okay, you can provide that to the committee.
Appreciate it, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Do you want someone for? You really want someone from the bar to come here?
Well,
I mean, we can arrange it.
Mr. Chairman, that would be helpful. I can also check, see what live body might be available to testify on that, but you also have a staff, so between the two of us, I would be helpful to have 5 minutes from the local private bar as to what could be done there.
We will make that happen. Did you want to testify?
I just wanted to make a really short statement in response to your question.
Can you please introduce yourself for the record?
My name is Tao Mei Shang. I'm the public policy specialist for the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. In response to your question, I just want to say that during stressful economic times, domestic violence programs across the country and also in Minnesota experience a significant upswing in requests for services by victims. This includes increased crisis calls to hotlines, requests for shelters, counseling, legal services, transitional housing, and services for children. And due to lack of resources, programs are having to cut hours and staffing, which prevents them from being able to provide the vast number of services needed by women seeking safety. Funding cuts are having a dramatic effect on programs that are already struggling to keep their doors open. And while economic stressors often lead to more frequent violent and dangerous abuse when domestic violence already exists, but we're not saying that this is the reason why there is domestic violence. So that's just a more broad answer to the question that you posed earlier.
Okay, are there any questions? Representative Coles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for either of the witnesses. Maybe Ms. Is it Zhang? Ms. Zhang?
Chong.
Ms. Zhang. Can you advise the committee a little bit as to what other states do with regard to battered women's funding or sexual assault victim funding? How does Minnesota rank compared to other states in terms of funding from state sources to the programs that you represent?
Ms. Zhang.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I actually don't have the answer to that, but I can get back to you.
Mr. Chairman,
I would
appreciate that. I think it's useful information. I don't know that it's it's obviously not going to completely drive our decisions, but having some information about how we compare to other states, many of whom are also dealing with fiscal challenges, I think would be interesting information. The other question I have for either of the witnesses. In the past, Mr. Chair and members, as you'll recall, there's been discussion around reserves and fund balances held by shelters and other programs. And so I'm just curious what the status, I wouldn't be surprised to hear that some of them have been drawn down and maybe are not as flush as they have been in the past. But I'm curious what the status is with regard to reserves and fund balances, either, ma'am, for your program or Ms. Zhang, more broadly speaking, for programs across the state.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Zhang.
Mr. Chairman, I actually don't have the answer to that. RED was supposed to be here, but she's currently not here, so I don't actually have the numbers. But I can get the answer to you.
Ms. Cook is here from the Coalition. Do you have anything to add to that, or can you? Well, why don't you come up if you can?
Mr. Chairman.
And also, we do have some of that data, the comparison data. I don't know how up-to-date it is, but Representative Smith would remember back when we did a little research on, I think we called it per diem back then. I don't know that it's still called per diem.
Mr. Chairman.
I don't know if that's dated now or what.
Mr. Chairman, I think the last report I've seen was 05 or 06.
Yeah. So I don't know. So there's someone from OJP here that is that something maybe when you come up I don't know, you don't have to come up right now, but I don't know how easy that would be to update that information, but or Ms. Cook if you have it, or anyway, there's a number of questions out here. You can decide to take whichever one you'd like. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, my name is Cindy Cook. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. I have to say I have a vocal cord issue, so it's difficult for me to talk, but please bear with me. And what was the question, if you wouldn't mind repeating?
Representative Coles.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Cook, I had essentially two questions. One is, how does Minnesota compare to other states with regard to funding from state sources for battered women's programs and criminal sexual assault type programs. And then secondly, there was the discussion a few years back around reserves and fund balances within shelters and other programs. I'm curious what the status is, even kind of generically speaking, other than I assume they've been drawn down to some extent, but do programs still have reserves or fund balances that that they can draw on if they need to?
Ms. Brooke.
Representative Coles, I don't have the exact figures that you're looking for, but I can tell you that across the country, it's quite different from state to state. So you'll have states in the southern part of the country that provide very little in terms of state resources, and they rely almost 100% on federal resources. And in those states, the services are quite minimal. In states like Wisconsin, that is perhaps more comparable to us, the funding levels are comparable. Florida has higher state funding levels, so it's kind of really across the board. Last year, the state of California cut their domestic violence services by 100% and then reinstated it after tremendous public outcry. So it's kind of, I think every state is faced with similar decisions to our state and have come up with different responses. But I could get some comparative data for some states with comparable populations, if that's helpful.
Was that both questions, or was that?
We didn't touch on the fund balance and reserve issue.
Ms. Moore?
I can speak to our fund balance. We definitely have spent down reserves that we had. In fact, to the point now where we can't do that any further. You want to have some kind of reserve, operating reserve, that you can keep in order to be fiscally responsible. And when you look at applying for grants through foundations and other sources, one of the things they look at is, do you have an operating reserve? Do you have monies that, you know, that are going to carry your organization through a difficult time? So we definitely have quite a bit less in our fund balance than we did, say, 3-4 years ago.
Senator Coles.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Moore, that response is not surprising at all. And the only comment I would make, and I really sincerely hope this doesn't sound too flip, but we don't have a fund balance right now either. We've got massive challenges, as you know, and so trying to figure out how we can prioritize the services that are most critical from a public safety perspective, these are certainly right up there. So please don't take my comment as, but we've, as you know, we have massive challenges. We don't have any fund balances either. We don't have any operational reserves. We're in a world of hurt, and I understand and appreciate that you are too.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Any other questions of the testifiers? Anything else you'd like to add?
No, I would add one thing, Mr. Chairman. That's, I think that the decisions before all of the committees this year are more difficult than I think you've faced in the past. We just appreciate the opportunity to come and share some of our information with you today. So thank you very much.
Okay. Ms. Moore, Ms. Cook, thank you for your testimony. And I don't know if it will be helpful, but we can try to find the report that was done. It's, albeit dated, but if you think it would be helpful. I don't know where else you'd get the comparable data to compare states, but
cool.
Can you get it?
I could do some comparative across states of comparable size. I don't think I can
that'd
get
be good.
Across the country.
Okay, that'd be good. Thank you. Okay, thank you both for your testimony.
Thank you.
Okay, next we'll hear from the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. Ms. Dunn, if you'd introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Pimer and members of the committee. My name is Donna Dunn. I am Executive Director of the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. MNCASA provides education, training, advocacy for Minnesota sexual violence service programs and represents over 70 of those member programs throughout the state. We serve as a voice for victims and survivors of sexual violence and concerned citizens committed to stopping sexual violence in Minnesota, as well as allied professionals and communities that are working in their roles to stop sexual violence. I appreciate your focus on this issue today, and I'm here to offer some brief comments about the political impact of reductions to the sexual assault grant program, a potential impact, excuse me. I've distributed some general summary information about the program to committee members, And within that information, I've also included a copy of what's called the minimum program standards that grantees are expected to meet for their average of $40,000 per year per program. These minimum program standards, and I'm saying this because I want to help you understand what the typical day at a sexual assault advocacy, what an advocate's life is involved in doing. Those program standards include providing 24-hour access to crisis services. So that would be access to law enforcement, to advocacy, to crisis support, to accompaniment to the local hospital for an evidentiary exam. Support groups, making support groups available for survivors, for family members of survivors, for parents of children who've been sexually assaulted. And it also includes general assistance to survivors. That's a fairly large category that includes meeting a victim survivor at the emergency room, accompanying a victim survivor to meetings with law enforcement, with the prosecutor, going to a school to intervene on behalf of a victim with school administration to help the victim express his or her needs, working with college campuses on intervening with sexual violence and so forth. This minimum programmatic standard also requires that programs do staff development, including that related to volunteers, volunteer recruitment training, and supervision, as well as staff supervision training and board training. Minimum program and standards also require programs to reach out to the community, to train the community, to let the community know about the dynamics of sexual violence. We also are directed to help our communities develop protocol and practice and procedure with community systems that are intervening in cases of sexual assault. We're expected to train professionals in our community. And we are also expected, and this is a great thing, to collaborate for effective community outcomes to better intervene in or to prevent incidents of sexual violence. Well, these are the critical core services that these grants fund. For $40,000, a county, and that's an average. This is a big bargain for the state and a huge demand on programs. I will limit my comments to describing what we are learning from our members about the likely on-the-ground impact of reductions and offering suggestions about how to minimize the impact of any reductions. The governor's supplemental budget, we are very happy to see, recognizes that sexual assault grant program is a core public safety service and does not recommend reductions. However, we appreciate the legislature's need to consider all options, and we certainly hear this morning from you that you are considering all options in crafting a proposal to deal with the state's chronic budget deficit. We did ask our programs to tell us what would a 3 to 6% cut in state funding mean to them? How might it affect their services? And again, please keep in mind that we're talking about relatively small programs or agencies, typically just over a 1 FTE position in a county, and that the average size of the program grant, again, as I say, is about $40,000. Here's what we heard from programs when we asked that question. Budgets are already stretched. As one program described the situation, quote, "We are already asking for donations for office supplies. We've cut the continuing education and training budget for our 5-person staff to $300. Another program noted, "We recently downsized from 4 to 3 staff and reduced our executive director's salary to part-time equivalency." Programs depend on volunteers to staff crisis lines, to meet victims at emergency rooms or law enforcement centers, often in the middle of the night, and to accompany victims to services, to court, to appointments. Volunteers provide many of those critical frontline services in many communities across Minnesota. Advocacy programs value that volunteer contribution, and they do believe that drawing volunteers in to assist in meeting the demand in a community is an important way of bringing more community attention and support to this issue. Reductions in mileage and expense reimbursement for volunteers will make it difficult to maintain a volunteer program and to meet the state grant program expectations for providing 24-hour access to these services. For most of our programs, the relatively small amount of funding necessary to support training, supervision, and out-of-pocket costs for volunteers, and those costs such as mileage, can expand a program's ability, if FTE services, advocacy services, oftentimes twofold. In other words, volunteers can often double the amount of advocacy time available to victim survivors in a community. We also heard that cuts in mileage budgets will require staff in Greater Minnesota to more rigidly limit travel, and that travel would be used to accompany victims to critical medical or legal appointments. Staff hours will be reduced, that's clear. And this will most likely result in elimination of risk reduction or community prevention and education services. As you heard from Connie Moore, those are the kinds of services that we look at having to go first. We will do our best to meet the emergency needs of victim survivors. In short, program capacity to deliver basic services is crumbling. The core service of 24-hour access to crisis intervention support is threatened, and even the most basic sexual violence awareness and prevention education activities are already being set aside. This is critical for us because sexual assault, we know, is a largely unreported, a highly underreported issue. Most studies and research that have been done indicate that only between 16 and 20% of victims ever report an assault to law enforcement. And we know that these are also very tricky cases, difficult cases to investigate. It's not unusual for a reported sexual assault involving a non-stranger to the victim may take as long as 12 months for the investigation to be completed and charges to be determined. During that time, having access to an advocate who can continue to support a victim while those decisions are being made, while the investigation is going on, is really critical to the ability for the court process then to move forward if, in fact, there are charges that come in a case. Well, recent budget decisions by the legislature suggest an understanding and recognition, and I'm talking about past decisions, of the importance and vulnerability of local sexual assault programs. In 2007, the legislature approved a 2% permanent increase in funding for these programs, as well as a 2% one-time increase. This was the first increase for these services in 10 years. A decrease, which you suggest we should be thinking about, of up to 7% would return us to early 1990s amounts to early 1990s funding level. We also understand that actual dollars and purchasing power would not even meet that. We're talking about an even greater loss. I would also say that because of lack of health care, many survivors are not able to support and afford therapy or treatment services in their local community, so they are relying even more on the available services of an advocate at a sexual assault program to receive that support, counseling during the course of their early recovery and healing. Facing budget reductions last year, the legislature directed the Department of Public Safety to protect direct services by capping cuts to sexual violence grant at 3%. With the help, as you know, of federal stimulus dollars, the department demonstrated its commitment to trying to minimize the effect of coping with budget challenges on direct services for victims and survivors by allocating some of its federal stimulus grant to temporarily minimize those cuts. We appreciated that. Protecting the core integrity of sexual assault victim services will require a similar approach. Programs will need to find ways to absorb cuts, and the legislature and the department will need to clearly acknowledge this means a temporary reduction or elimination of certain services that are currently required as a part of state contracting. Additionally, the department, as it has done in the past, may need to set aside some of its less critical services in order to minimize reductions in state funding for direct services. In closing, I would like to remind the committee that we are having the conversation today about doing what we can to minimize harm to the system of small community-based programs providing assistance to nearly 10,000 victims of sexual violence in Minnesota each year. We don't have a choice. The conversation we need to be having is how to make these programs stronger and how we're going to address the fact that still, and I repeat this each time I meet with you, 13 counties in Minnesota and 5 Indian reservations in Minnesota continue to go without any state-funded services. But that's a conversation we will have, unfortunately, to save until the future. Thank you very much for the opportunity for me to contribute our input and thoughts to your budget deliberations.
Thank you, Ms. Dunn. Can you just tell me, I was just asking Mr. Carter, I was trying to figure out how much actual general fund dollars go into sexual assault programming, and I'll get that information if you don't have it, but I'd like to know also, do you also get funding from the Department of Human Services for your prevention end, or does that all come from DPS or federal money?
Mr. Chair, we do not receive any funding from the Department of Human Services. Our advocacy programs, also do not receive funding for prevention. The coalition, Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault, receives some funding from the Minnesota Department of Health. To help train and support the infrastructure for beginning the conversations about primary prevention. To date, there is not any health department money that is granted to community-based advocacy programs. So our task is to bring that information to our programs.
So in the best of all worlds financially, would you be, I mean, obviously the primary goal is to provide services to victims of sexual assault, but I know that there's been and I know you had a conference earlier this year about what are we doing on the prevention end, and do you see your coalition moving in that direction in the future, or will that be difficult given the budget constraints that you're under?
Well, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we are very committed to expanding the dialogue about primary prevention of sexual violence. We have worked hard in collaboration with many others in the state over decades to address crimsex statutes, sentencing, to do risk reduction education with potential victims. We've tried a number of strategies, and in fact, none of those have resulted in actually stopping the production, quote unquote, of sex offenders. We know that we are still growing sex offenders at an alarming rate, and we haven't been able to stem that tide. So we do have a commitment to continuing to raise the issue of primary prevention. We know it is it's something that we have to do in order to make the sustainable change that will ultimately help us with budget challenges such as we're facing right now. I know that you all know about the cost of sexual violence report that the Health Department issued a couple of years ago that indicated this issue cost Minnesota $8 billion in 1 year. And so we know that it is something that we have got to figure out how to turn the tide on. We have got to address that. So we are committed to doing that. We will continue to do that primary prevention work. It cannot happen at the expense of good intervention and support for victims, as well as good, thoughtful strategies for intervening with sex offenders. I would like to add, Mr. Chair, that the general revenue dollar for sexual assault programs for this year is $1.3 million.
I just got that. Thank you.
Okay.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Dunn, thank you for all that you do and for all the sexual assault services programs in the state of Minnesota. I happen to be privileged to be on the sexual assault board of directors for my local state sexual assault services chapter in my district. And I've been on that board for about 4 years now. And I would encourage members to visit your local sexual assault service program if you have one, because what you're going to see is this. You're going to see staff that, you know, is completely dedicated to helping folks to the point that they take less money, they work more hours, they want the programs to survive because they know the importance of this program to address victims and to also address the $8 billion problem that we have in the state of Minnesota with this. Also, as I've sat on the board for the last 4 years, I've noticed that 4+ years maybe even now, I'm not even sure, but I've noticed that we talk about prevention and education. We had a great education component in our sexual assault services program that now, because of funding constraints, has taken a secondary role to the intervention for the victims. So as we lose funding, the component of the program, the education component for the prevention of sexual assault in our state, the thing that we can, you know, make it more fiscally wise and responsible has, in fact, taken a secondary role, sadly. So I just wanted, again, to point out that in greater Minnesota, for sure, I've had the opportunity to see and witness firsthand that, and I encourage members to do the same in your local communities.
Thank you, Representative Coles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Mr. Carger, the $1.3 million general fund appropriation, is that inclusive of OJP grants to these programs, or are the OJP grants, to the extent that they're available and obtained by sexual assault victims programs, is that additional?
Mr. Carger.
Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, that is the general fund appropriation, and maybe when the DPS comes up here, Department of Public Safety, we can ask them. I think I don't know if they're receiving any of the federal grants. That could be an addition to that.
Representative Coles.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Carger, I guess I'm not sure that answers the question. I just don't have the budget stuff in front of me, but OJP, I believe, had $75 million appropriated for grants to a general fund appropriation of $75 million. And so the question is that $1.3 million inclusive of OJP grants for these programs, or is that a separate appropriation that is outside of that bucket of money that we gave to OJP and then OJP grants out?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Carter, that is part of that 70-some million dollars.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Ms. Dunn, similar questions to what I asked the last two testifiers. How does Minnesota compare to other states in terms of state funding for criminal sexual assault victims programs and the various programs that exist across the state today? Mm-hmm. What are their fund balances, reserves? do they have them at all? Mm-hmm. And if so, to what level?
Ms. Dunn.
Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, I don't have information about how we compare with other states. I do know that at the outset of this work, decades ago, Minnesota was a leader in terms of its commitment to funding these programs. I'm not entirely sure how other states have compared, but I will also work to get that information and provide it to you. I think that I can safely say that sexual assault programs don't carry a fund balance. We are talking about really, really under-resourced programs, and they rely largely on volunteers for their on-the-ground services. So, I would be very surprised if there were a program that had the kind of reserves that actually most private foundations and donors would like to see a nonprofit carry in order to ensure that they're stable.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Dunn. There's one more question for you, Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Dunn, I was just curious, is there a percentage amount, or do you know the percentage amount that is funded by either of those, one, the private donations, and two, if it is funded federally with programs, what percentage of that of your total budget?
Ms. Dunn.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kelly, I don't have in front of me a spreadsheet that would help me answer that, but I think we can get the answer for you. In terms of donors, I know that many of our programs do spend a lot of energy working, trying to raise cash from their community donors. So there's a lot of effort put into grassroots fundraising and to gain both community support as well as community understanding of the issue. But I'm sure, I would suspect that OJP might have the answer for you about how many federal dollars go into sexual assault services and could answer that question. Mr. Chair, if I could add one more thought about prevention.
Yes, please.
One of our strategies is to, and this came out of our Minnesota Summit to Prevent Sexual Violence, is to really engage other partners and other sectors in identifying their role in preventing sexual violence. This is not a task that advocates can do alone, but our focus is really to bring business and industry, to bring the faith community, education, healthcare providers, really the vast array of people who have an interest in healthy communities into this issue, to see that they have a role in creating in their particular sector, in the place where they have some power, the kind of environment that we know prevents sexual violence. So the prevention issue doesn't belong only to this movement, but we are working on bringing in what we call the unusual suspects, to say, what is your role and how can you start acting in your role to help us all?
We
Very good. Thank you, Ms. Dunn.
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we'll hear from the Office of Justice Programs. Well, did you have a question? Well, Ms. There's a comment, so maybe it's not. I'm sorry, Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment, Representative Coles, Representative Kelly, great questions. I want to assure you that the sexual assault program that I am committed to and work with goes on an operational budget of day by day. There's no reserve there. And the volunteers, I spoke about the staff at giving, but the volunteers are critical. That's how programs survive in our communities. And to the donor, to the private community kind of donor programs, our sexual assault program holds many fundraisers throughout the year, and I want to make sure there's one in particular that Commissioner Campion was at, and it's called Walk a Mile in Her Shoes, mm-hmm. where males come to this and walk a mile in high heels. And raise money, and but it also is an awareness thing, a huge awareness thing. So there's the local programs significantly work on raising local dollars to get commitment to from our local community as well. So I just want to make sure that those points were given as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We'd both be taller than Rick Abina.
We've got several more presentations here. Is there a comment? Oh, okay. Is Tricia Hummel here? Ms. Hummel, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the committee, and then I guess we want to cover a few things. If you can answer any of the questions that are sort of still out there, hanging out there, that were asked by the committee about those two programs, and then also sort of where we're at with some of the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act spending, and we did not ask all the OJP programs that get funding passed through the federal government to testify here, but just give us a snapshot of where things are.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Representatives. I'm Tricia Hummel. I'm the Assistant Director of the Office of Justice Programs. I'll do my best to answer some of the questions that were put out, and I can certainly get you more detail if I don't have it. Do you want me to start trying to respond to some of those questions, or do you want me to go through them?
Well, briefly, if you can.
Let's see. There were a number of questions about the cuts. We did take reductions of $1.7 million in the last fiscal year, with a 3% max on the youth intervention programs and the crime victims services, which we were talking about earlier. Some of these cuts had one-time mitigations that we were able to make. That's the point I really want to make. We did get some Recovery Act money that I'll be talking more about, but some of that was used for some of the crime victim grants, so that was a one-time mitigation. We were also able to use some other federal money to mitigate that cut to crime victims. So if the 3% cut still stands and they get an additional 7% cut, that would be a 10% total cut, and that would have a significant impact. The other cuts from last year, so they came out, some came out of 3% out of the youth intervention program, which also lost the $750,000 increase that they had been given the year before. So they, we were having to defund some of the youth intervention programs. Crime victims cuts were largely mitigated by one-time federal money that was available. And then the third area that saw cuts was the task forces, and those were mitigated by the closing of the gang strike force last summer. So a lot of those, again, are one-time aid that we were able to provide for those cuts that won't be available. So any cuts this year would be on top of the cuts that were made last year but not seen. Does that make sense?
Yes, Ms. Hummel. So in other words, the next year, though, the 3% cut that we made will become a reality to the base budget. Would that be accurate? Unless there's a second federal stimulus.
Correct.
So any further cuts would be on top of that.
Yes.
Okay.
I'm trying to remember if there were other questions that were not answered earlier.
There's obviously, Ms. Hummel, as long as you're looking around, you know amount there. There's obviously this additional federal money flowing in, and I do hope this committee, when trying to figure out a solution to the gang strike force issue, which a bill will be coming here shortly, but I was just seeing that I think that Ramsey County just got a $500,000 grant for their violent offenders task force or whatever they're being called now. So where's that money coming from? Is that just is that a specific pot of federal money, or is that
That's state money. Mr.
That's all state money.
Mm-hmm.
And where's that coming from?
That, excuse me a second. That this year's fund? Yeah. Calling up some financial expert aid here. I believe that is our.
Is that part of the $10 million or $8 million grant that or $8 million line item that we have for gang strike forces?
That's my understanding. I'm wondering where the money for the new grants is. And that's the current state. That's correct, Mr. Chair. That's coming out of the gang strike force appropriation.
Okay. Would you please introduce yourself for the record and just explain this a little bit?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Frank Ahrens, Finance Director for Public Safety.
So I'd like you to explain this a little bit. I'm just trying to figure out how these grants get made. I think there's an $8 million appropriation for the biennium for gang strike forces. So everything's still going on as normal, so to speak. Is that these multi-jurisdictional task forces then make a request of the oversight committee for money, and then that's made, and then the department? I was sort of struck by when I saw that in the paper.
Yeah, I can speak to a little bit of that. A portion of that money is for the Greater Minnesota Task Forces, and they have been carrying on as they have been. They had a request for proposals, and funding decisions were made a number of months ago. It was the metro area funds that have been being discussed for a number of months, and I have not been in the day-to-day discussions on those. My understanding is that the decisions were just made, and that was what the article in the paper was referring to. So that's the remainder of the state appropriation that has not been allocated to Greater Minnesota.
Okay. You know, we really should have carved out a little time for all this, and maybe we should in one of our future committee hearings to find out how all that money is being used. Is that federal money, or is that
state money?
It's all general fund money. Okay.
And I apologize, I didn't really come prepared to talk about
that. And I didn't, that's our fault. I didn't ask. I just came out because I saw it in the newspaper. I just thought, where's that coming from? So, okay. Okay, anything else you want to tell us, Ms. Hummel, about the stimulus money, where it's all going? And then, assuming that there's not going to be stimulus money in the future, I suspect all of these programs are going to take a 3% cut then. The youth intervention, et cetera, et cetera.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
All the time.
You all have copies of the handout on the stimulus money. I can run through that quickly if you want to hear that level of detail, or not if you don't want me to.
Sure. I'm not sure that we got that handout.
Yeah. Some people have it, I see. Yeah. Do you want me to take a few minutes and go through that and tell you how we spent the stimulus money?
Oh, it's your PowerPoint, the PowerPoint presentation? Okay. Not all of these sheets. If you want to just take a few minutes to do that, can
sure.
you just sort of highlight some?
Certainly. The key components of the Recovery Act are that it's to preserve and create jobs, assist those most impacted by the recession, and to stabilize state and local budgets. This is one-time funding over a 2 to 3 year period, depending on the specific fund. We're still not hearing anything new about renewals, so we're still expecting it to be one-time funding. It has quick start requirements, so it wasn't really appropriate for new startup operations anyway. and it has a lot of expedited reporting and transparency and accountability attached to it. Office of Justice Programs received nearly $21 million in stimulus money through three existing federal formula grant programs. The first one of those is the Victims of Crime Act funds, the VOCA, which got about $1.2 million. A portion of that was used for the ongoing Compensation for Crime Victims Fund. And then a portion of that was integrated into the annual formula, and that was used to mitigate some of the state cuts that we talked about earlier. The next federal fund that got funds was the Violence Against Women Act funds, the VAWA funds. We received about $2.4 million in that federal program for the STOP program. That is used to develop and strengthen law enforcement and prosecution strategies, as well as another portion for victim services. So that money was distributed through two competitive RFP processes. There are federal distribution requirements that mandate a percentage goes for one kind of service and another percentage for another. So we had to have two different processes. The collaborative projects for criminal justice systems change, which get 55% of that money. There were 44 proposals seeking a total of $4.8 million. We had about a little over $1 million available, and we funded 10 grants there. The direct services portion of the VAWA funds, we had 72 proposals submitted seeking a little over $2 million, and we had less than $1 million available, but we made 12 grants out of that money. Then the third federal program that got stimulus money was the Byrne Justice Assistance Act grants, the JAG money. We got $18 million through that program. The key components, so all of these programs have your overall Recovery Act requirements attached to it, and then each federal program that the money flows through has its own requirements. With the JAG money, you have to address one of the purpose areas, which are listed in one of the later slides there. There is a no supplant provision, so you can't redirect current money you have. It has to be new or supplemental. Have to employ best or evidence-based practices in your initiative and improve the criminal justice system in some way. This money was awarded through a competitive request for proposal process last summer. Again, let's see, within this there are two eligible applicant categories, so $10.5 million was available for local agencies and $5.5 million for state agencies. Again, that's a federal requirement that 66% has to get passed through to locals, so that's how those amounts were, where they came from. We received a total of 334 proposals, seeking a total of almost $112 million. So obviously there's a lot of demand out there for these funds, making the review quite a challenge. The next chart, which is a little, I'm sorry I don't have the PowerPoint presentation, but that is a breakdown of the purpose areas and just showing, it's just a snapshot of how much was requested, how many proposals were received in each purpose area. The way we reviewed these grants, these proposals, was they get divided by purpose area and geographic area. So, for example, all the prevention proposals from northern Minnesota get reviewed together. We used 180 volunteer reviewers in about 36 different review groups, which meant that each proposal is reviewed by 4 to 6 different people. They rate the proposals based on criteria outlined in the RFP. And only the top scoring ones were recommended. So obviously a lot of worthwhile programs were not able to be funded, only the top one or two in each review group.
Okay, any questions, Mr. Ms. Hummel? We don't have to wrap this up. Representative Coles.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Hummel, if you can either provide this now or going forward, the current biennium, we provided a $75 million general fund appropriation to OJP. I understand there were $21 million in stimulus funds to OJP. I'd like to know what the other federal funding is that runs through OJP in terms of dollars. And then the other information I'm interested in seeing is by percentage or by however you want to provide me the information, can you show me how the money, all inclusive of state funds and federal funds, is dispersed, crime victims programs. You have some of that in here with regard to the stimulus money. I'd like mm-hmm. to see how that looks when we consider all of the money that is granted out through OJP, through all the various funding sources that you have.
Okay. Ms. Hummel, can you provide that to the committee?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative. So you want to see the total federal funds, the total state funds, and how they're dispersed?
Yes.
Okay. And generally, it's kind of the same processes, but we can sure get it.
And Mr. Chair, Ms. Hummel, is there any indication that I understand that the stimulus money is one-time money. Is there any indication that you're hearing that federal funding, non-stimulus funding, is going to be cut or reduced in the years going forward, or is there any indication that it might be increased?
Ms. Hummel.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the last thing I looked at, this funding levels were about the same.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Hummel. We'll have you back, or Ms. Ellison back, as we move into the budget deliberation. I'm going to take things a little out of order here because it was the second time. I didn't want Mr. Kennedy to have to leave again, and we really do want to hear about the Adam Walsh Act. So, Mr. Kennedy, please introduce yourself for the record and tell us about the Adam Walsh Act and what we are doing or not doing, what we should be doing.
Chair members, Mr. Chair, members, Harry Kennedy, I'm the State Sex Offender Policy Coordinator, and here today to give you a brief overview of the Adam Walsh Act. Title I of the Adam Walsh Act is the Sex Offender Registration and Notification Act. It's commonly referred to as SORNA, and that's the topic of discussion today. What is it? SORNA is a comprehensive national system for registration and community notification for sex offenders. What it does is it supersedes the Jacob Wetterling Act and Megan's Law and other amendments to the Jacob Wetterling Act. It does not establish one national sex offender registry. What it does is it creates national standards for state sex offender registries, community notification programs, and registration verification processes. There was a concern at the federal level that the Jacob Wetterling Act, which established sex offender registries in states, and Megan's Law, which established community notification, that there was too much discretion given to the states in determining how many people are put on a public website, what information is provided. Therefore, this act serves to eliminate that state discretion and create uniform standards. Here's a timeline of SORNA implementation. It was enacted July 27, 2006. And one of the key dates here to look at, July 1st, 2008, that it took the feds 2 years to issue their final federal guidelines. Obviously, until the states knew what the playing field was going to be, the act was passed, but in terms of interpreting the act, the guidelines weren't issued for 2 years. So states were waiting to see what those guidelines were. When they were, and what that did was it essentially took 2 years from the states to implement or strongly consider the Adam Walsh Act, because it was uncertain as to what the playing field would be with certain policy issues and decisions that were rendered in the Code of Federal Regulations. There were also some hearings in the spring of 2009 in the U.S. House, which some people said were going to point toward amendments to the Act. The states had raised some concerns with certain policies with SORNA, and there were some hearings held, and there was a thought that the Act might be amended. That did not happen. The National Governors Association, in fact, is conferring this week with the Department of Justice on the issue of an extension, a blanket extension for all states, but also various policy issues. And so right now, with what we're looking at, the deadline to comply was July 27, 2009. Minnesota last year The prudent course of action was to seek an extension, which the state did, as did many other states. And the feds actually, in May 26, 2009, granted a blanket extension to all the states. That SORNA compliance, the SORNA compliance deadline was then July 27th of this year. There is a possibility for another one-year extension. Many states, most states, are seeking extensions again. I think it is, again, a prudent course of action with the time we have to look at some of the policy issues with SORNA more closely. So Minnesota should consider the filing the extension. And an extension needs to be filed anyways to apply for grants, which is something that we are doing as well, providing, applying for federal grant money for SORNA implementation. Implementation initially here, as you can see, was 3 years from date of enactment or 1 year of delivery of software for SORNA website. That has come and gone, but a request for extension may be granted. There are up to two one-year extensions provided for in the guidelines. There is a non-compliance penalty stated in the Act, and that is 10% of a state's burn grant funds if states do not comply with Adam Walsh Act implementation. SORNA is a comprehensive federal act, and there are, I've listed here some bullet points of the key policy issues. Now, Minnesota has been moving forward on SORNA compliance in other areas, such as the infrastructure of, improving the infrastructure of the predatory offender registry and the database, including possible digitization of documents. It is key to first get that infrastructure in place, and that's what the state is working on. But there are also major policy issues in terms of SORNA compliance that have to be decided. First, and what these boil down to is essentially three kind of categories. How many offenders does a state want to put on a public website? How much info will you provide on that public website? Relative to each offender, and how many in-person verification visits or verification of the registration information, what that process is going to look like for a state. The first bullet point, expanded public access to register information. Under SORNA, virtually all registered sex offenders in a state, with some exceptions, are required to be on a public website. There are 8 mandatory items of information that must be included on each of those offenders, and I will get to that in a little bit. And the website, public website, must be searchable by a zip code or geographic radius search, so a person can log on, enter a zip code, and see information about an offender living in that area will come up. Also, another policy decision is enhanced offender registry information. Right now, the BCA has a very comprehensive proprietary predatory offender registry database. We are fairly solid on this registry information. We virtually collect almost all of the information that SORNA requires, and the majority of that is not made public. Law enforcement and criminal justice entities have access to that information. The third key policy issue is in-person registration verification. Right now in Minnesota, that is accomplished by sending out annual letters to offenders at their last known address, and there's a 96, and they return those letters to the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension regarding their residence, and there's a 96% compliance rate right now with that process. There are technological enhancements. Minnesota has implemented some unique technological enhancements with Department of Justice grants and is continuing to work on expanding and improving upon the registry. The DOJ, in fact, some of these technological innovations were so innovative that DOJ asked Minnesota to present on the technological upgrades at the 2008 SORNA National Conference. So there's good work being done. Juvenile registration is another key policy concern. Right now in Minnesota, we register juveniles. However, that information is not made public. Under SORNA, for juveniles 14 and older that commits serious sex crimes, SORNA requires that juvenile information be placed on a public website. And then finally, retroactivity. While it's not stated in the Act, the guidelines state that SORNA should be implemented retroactively. And that has been a major source of litigation in various states that I'll get to.
So, Ken, I just have a quick question here, just as long as we're going through this. So with all of these registries and all of this data becoming public, and I've been around the legislature long enough where when we started implementing some of these policies to give the public knowledge about a sex offender moving into a neighborhood, I'm also cognizant of the collateral consequences to these kinds of offenses for someone trying to get a job when their name is on a, when their name is listed as a registered sex offender. So the, that question, I guess the question is beyond the public's right to know, which is important. Does the, do we have any research to show that these kinds of activities actually deter sexual violence in our communities?
There was a Department of Corrections study done not too long ago that broad community notification, at least for your high-risk offenders, level threes, non-compliant offenders, possibly level two offenders, does reduce the risk of recidivism. And I don't Bill Denae from the Department of Corrections Risk Assessment Unit has, I believe, presented to this committee and others, but there is a positive impact, at least on for high-risk offenders. The greater community notification, greater possibility for reduced recidivism. Now, when you compare that to putting all sex offenders on a public website, there has not been much research done as to the effect of putting everybody on a public website. In Minnesota, we focus on level three offenders. There's a DOC public website for level three offenders that are living in a community, and also the BCA has a non-compliant public website for anyone that is non-compliant with their registration obligations under 243.166, and there's about 700 people on that website. So that's been the focus on Minnesota, on the high-risk offenders. The policy issue that we must consider is, do we go further than that?
So but just so I understand, so the SORNA core compliance issues would require all sex offenders to be much more publicly exposed. That would, not just level three sex offenders.
Yes, Mr. Chair, virtually, there will be some exceptions. There's 15,500 registered sex offenders in Minnesota. The great majority of those would be required to be on a public website under SORNA.
Representative Eastland?
He just answered my question. There's 16,000 some that will be on this register?
There's 15,500 approximately registered sex offenders in Minnesota, and the great majority of those would be on a public website, sir.
Very good. Please continue.
SORNA states that to become compliant, you must make available on the Internet, as the quote says there, in a manner readily accessible to all jurisdictions, information about each sex offender in the registry. And this is done. The website must contain required data that we'll get to in the next slide that is searchable by zip code or geographical radius. There also must be a function for automatic updates that can be sent to people who provide their email addresses. And if a registered offender moves into their area, they will receive an update about that. The website also must be searchable for specific email addresses and must participate in the Drew Shedin National Sex Offender Public Website, which we already are a participant in. These are the 8 core items of information, mandatory items of information that SORNA requires must be placed on a public website concerning each offender. Name and any aliases, residence address, as well as if someone is homeless, specifying the general area where that person is homeless. Addresses of employer and school, if applicable. License plate number and description of any vehicle. This would also include any watercraft or aircraft. A physical description of the offender. Sex offense history and a current photograph of the registered offender. That's the bottom line. That's the floor of what a state needs to put on their public website about each offender to be SORNA compliant. That is different than from the next slide, what the state is required to collect on a registry. States can decide to go further than that ceiling and put more information on a public website, but that last slide was the minimum. This is what SORNA requires that states, the type of information that states collect on each offender. And some of these are also listed on the public website, but for instance, telephone and cell phone numbers, social security number, digitized copies of passport and travel and immigration documents, professional licenses, carrying on to the next page, you'll see name and address of school where, I'm sorry, before I go to the next slide, name and address of school where registrant is involved. Under the public website, you just have to put the address of the school, but the state has to collect the name and other information regarding that school. The state could provide that if that decision is made, but right now not required to make the name of the school or the name of the employer public. And here's some more of the information that is required. With the exception of palm prints and digitized copies of passports and travel documents, Minnesota right now already collects the great amount of this information, so we are fairly compliant with this SORNA requirement.
Mr. Kennedy, if you could wrap up in the next few minutes, because I know there's committee questions and there's one person from the public that would like to testify against the Adam Walsh Act. Representative Cornish, do you have a question now?
Yes, Mr. Chair, to the testifier, what's put in place to keep the states from massaging the term sex offender, calling them an offender, and then calling somebody more serious a sex offender? I mean, to get out of the requirements of SORNA, is there any way that somebody plays games around the definition of what's a sex offender or the degrees? Because all different states have all sorts of different definitions of sex offenders and scales of what.
Mr. Kennedy.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there are fairly strict definitions of what a sex offender is and a sex offense is under SORNA. I believe it's Section 114 of the Act. And so it would be very hard for a state to try and get around the definition of what a sex offender is.
Okay. Please finish up here.
Yes, this is just an example of the Drew Shedin National public website. You can log in if you want. We are compliant with this, and you just list the name, county or city, and a zip code, and it can tell you in every state information on a sex offender. In-person verifications, I mentioned that as a key issue. SORNA requires, especially for the most serious sex offenders, 4 in-person visits to law enforcement or law enforcement going to their home. That is where this will be a key expense for local law enforcement to enact the in-person verifications to the extent that SORNA mandates. Juvenile registration, we went over that, but this is an important policy issue. SORNA requires those 14 and older to register. The sexual act has to be by force or threat, rendering someone unconscious, or an attempt or conspiracy of the above. There is also an age difference exception of 4 years, where if the person is at least 13 years old and the offender was not more than 4 years older, the juvenile would not have to be put on a public website. Retroactivity, This is a big issue, litigation in other states concerning retroactive application of SORNA. There were about 6,000 district court cases filed, state district court cases filed in Ohio, which is right now is the only state that has been deemed compliant with SORNA. Maine and Alaska are also going through significant litigation in those states regarding retroactive application of SORNA. And there's right now a United States Supreme Court case, I believe oral argument was yesterday, concerning this issue. So we're waiting for a case law to play out as well before making some of these policy decisions. Finally, the last couple slides. This shows what Minnesota has been doing, and there's been a lot done related to SORNA compliance, either before the act was enacted or after. Some of the highlights. The BCA maintains a registration database that is very comprehensive. It is proprietary, and a lot of information kept on every registered sex offender in this state. Significantly, the BCA has introduced technology for online registration for sex offenders and online changes of information to their sex offender registration forms. This was the technological advancements that the DOJ, the SMART office, thought was so innovative that they asked Minnesota to present at the national conference on this issue. The infrastructure is key for this, and there's been a lot of work done on that thus far with SORNA compliance. Also, failure to register, the fifth bullet point there. We recognize that as a felony offense in Minnesota, up to 5 years imprisonment. That is one that exceeds the SORNA requirements. In 2000, Department of Corrections established a public website for level 3 predatory offenders. And also since October 2006, absconded or non-compliant offender information is posted on a BCA public website. And to date, the public has submitted 400 tips regarding offender whereabouts. So that's been very successful. And as stated before, Minnesota public websites, just level 3 offenders and non-compliant offenders. Minnesota also has a 10-year and a lifetime registration for sex offenders, predatory offender registration. Intensive supervised release is a very good program that we're monitoring the sex offenders in this state. And down toward the middle there, the BCA is testing proximity search and email notification software provided by the SMART office. Further example of increasing the technological enhancements, as well as the inclusion of $200,000 in the supplemental budget for enhancements to the predatory offender registry database for infrastructure compliance with SORNA. The Department of Justice would look very favorably on the enhancements to the registry database as a major step forward for SORNA compliance. So with that, I will take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Kennedy. Appreciate the update on that. And we won't have time to hear from Superintendent O'Malley on the governor's recommendation on the computer infrastructure recommendation that you're speaking about, but we'll have him the next time we have DPS over and looking at their budget. But thank you, Mr. Kennedy, for your presentation. We have one person in the audience that would like to speak about the Adam Walsh Act, and then we'll adjourn. Could you please state your name for the record, please?
Michael Thompson.
If you could just try to keep your promise to about a couple minutes.
I will. Chairman Paymar, committee members. My name is Dr. Michael Thompson. I'm a licensed psychologist in Minnesota. I'm president of the Minnesota Association for the Treatment of Sexual Abusers. MNATSA, as it's known, is a state chapter of the Association for the Treatment of Sexual Abusers, an international organization devoted to the science and practice of sexual offender evaluation, treatment, and management. MNATSA currently has approximately 110 members made up of sexual offender evaluators, treatment providers, as well as probation agents, polygraph examiners, and corrections officials within the state of Minnesota. MNATSA stands as an interested stakeholder in all aspects of sexual offender policy. Today, my organization wishes to address aspects of the Adam Walsh Act. I will not rehash what Mr. Kennedy has presented, especially as it relates to SORNA. My organization is opposed to the implementation of this legislation on numerous grounds, and I will detail our opposition. Minnesota's current sexual offender community notification system is based on risk. Registration is based on committing one of a number of listed offenses. Length of registration is marginally related to risk, as any repeat offender or an offender convicted of criminal sexual conduct against a victim under age 13, for example, must register for life. The AWA's registration and notification system is not based on risk, but is based instead on a subjective criteria related to the assumed seriousness of a particular crime. In this, the AWA registration system expands the number of crimes that subject an offender to registration. It doesn't limit them to serious crimes or repeat offenses. Standardizing an overbroad list does not improve the current system as it stands now, especially if the standardization is not based on objective or empirical specific criteria to the risk of the offender. There is an extensive amount of research regarding community notification issues, and I will be happy to provide the committee the latest data on this issue within the week. For example, using a sample of registered sex offenders in New York State, a 2007 study examined the effectiveness of the Adam Walsh Act tier system to classify offenders by likelihood of recidivism. Results indicated that the provisions of the AWA, the Adam Walsh Act, fall short of increasing public safety. In fact, registered sex offenders classified by AWA as Tier 1 or lowest risk were rearrested for non-sexual and sexual offenses more than offenders in Tier 2 or Tier 3 categories. Secondly, MNATSA has serious concerns about public notification aspect of SORNA as it pertains to juvenile offenders. The AWA proposes registration and public notification via website of juveniles with many, if not all, the same criteria of adults. Mr. Kennedy outlined this. In addition to offenses such as forcible rape, the statute covers any offense involving a sex act with a victim under the age of 12. There are no provisions for risk assessment hearing in the case of juveniles adjudicated delinquent and subject to registration under the SORNA provisions. There are no exceptions for intrafamilial cases of sexual abuse. The only exception is a so-called Romeo and Juliet clause, whereby the law makes clear that jurisdictions will be not required to register persons convicted of sex offenses involving consensual sexual activity between a victim who is at least 13 years old and offender not more than 4 years older than the victim. Where I'm coming from is that SORNA creates a strict scheme where the discretion of a judge and a prosecutor are taken away. In cases of juveniles, this presents a particular challenge. We know that adolescence is a time when a person's identity is being formed and that who they are as a person is developing. Research also indicates that the vast majority of offenders adjudicated guilty of sex offenses as juveniles do not repeat these crimes as adults. Do we really want to encourage juveniles to adopt the identity of sex offender? And in doing so, would that raise or lower the likelihood of reoffense? MNATSA fears that the AWA may lead to consequences unintended by the original authors of the legislation. By placing everyone who has ever been convicted of a sex crime into the internet registry, the government is essentially making it impossible for parents to identify who is truly a threat and who is not. It has been argued that money spent monitoring relatively low-risk offenders is a questionable use of taxpayer money and resources. Lastly, we believe that the requirement that sex offender renew his or her registration 4 times a year is an exercise in unnecessary record keeping that seems designed to trap the unwary registrant who misses a deadline. What is the point of making a stable resident repeatedly renew his or her registration? We believe resources would be better used following up on out-of-compliant offenders at relatively higher risk than all offenders that might be included in the registry, especially at a time of fiscal austerity when budgets are already strained to meet current requirements. Wayne Logan, a professor at Florida State University, summed it up very well when he said, "There is indeed something odd, after all, about a system that depends on convicted criminals who have not demonstrated their inability or unwillingness to observe the law to step up and be responsible citizens and provide accurate information on themselves so that their lives can in turn be made more difficult. Minnesota's current registration already has one of the highest compliance rates in the nation. Why tinker with it? In conclusion, and I'll make this conclusion very brief, Mr. Chairman, MNATSA supports registration of sexual offenders and community notification in Minnesota, but with reasonable curves, a set length of time with the possibility of an out for a treated and successful offender, most information available to law enforcement only, and registration of primary and secondary addresses. Right now in Minnesota, the only way a registered offender gets on the internet is if he or she is a level 3 offender, which takes some work, and if he or she is non-compliant. Perhaps this is why Minnesota has such a high compliance rate, 96% via the BCA's own statistics. MNATSA fears expansion of the registry as mandated by AWA may have an effect on relative destabilization of individuals, resulting in additional offenses that might not otherwise have occurred. We know that stress increases the likelihood of people acting in a manner not in their own best interest. We must honestly ask ourselves, will publishing on the internet the home addresses of sexual offenders, regardless of risk, actually increase or hinder public safety? Will publishing on the internet the address of a sexual offender's place of employment actually increase our safety? Or will we create a class of offender who will be virtually unemployable, not because they cannot or do not wish to work and contribute to society, but because we make it unpalatable or unbeneficial for an employer to hire such an individual? Let me be clear. This is not to say that sexual offenders should not register or the community not be notified so as to not create undue stress upon the offender. However, it is vital that we as a state carefully evaluate an offender's real risk to the community against creating needless stress for what may be the illusion of community safety. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Thompson, for your comments. Any other questions with that? Representative Cornish?
Just love to have him back when we had more time to grill the testifier a little more, but
I'd be
Mr.
happy
Thompson,
to
Mr. Thompson, we'll have you come back so Representative Cornish can grill you.
Thank you, Matt.
Meeting's adjourned.